Hello and welcome back to Instant Mom. Today we are going to talk about open adoption, what it is, how you get one, and creating an open adoption agreement. And I'll also talk about what that agreement even is. If this episode is interesting to you, you may also want to check out my last two episodes that touch on similar topics. One was called, "I've Just Been Asked to Adopt My Foster Child, Now What?" And that can help you navigate if you are ready to adopt through foster care, or perhaps if your calling is just to be a foster parent and not to adopt. And then the second episode I would recommend is called "The Icky Power Dynamics of Mediation." And that goes into greater detail on a step right before a biological parent's rights are terminated. In some states, it is a mandated step where you go into mediation with the biological parents and try to convince them to voluntarily terminate their parental rights instead of having to go to a trial and have a judge make that decision. That shares some personal stories about my mediation experience with Jack's biological parents, and also digs into more of the emotional side of what going through a mediation can look and feel like. We will cover mediation a little bit in this episode as well, because it is or can be part of an open adoption or come right before an open adoption, but the other episode will get a little bit more into it. Okay, so first, what is an open adoption? I have occasionally heard some people get this confused with co-parenting, and they think that an open adoption means that the biological parents still have some kind of rights or decision-making power, or that you're somehow sharing parental responsibilities and parenting tasks with the biological parents. And that is not at all true. In an open adoption, the biological parents' rights are legally terminated. They are no longer a parent in sort of any legal sense of the word. They don't get to make decisions. They don't have any legal power or authority. They are just as much a parent to your child as a stranger on the street might be, legally speaking. An open adoption just means there is some kind of contact or information shared between you as the adoptive family and your child and the biological family. And there is a whole spectrum of what this can mean. On one end of the spectrum, this may just mean that maybe once a year you will snail mail some photos of the children to a mailing address of the biological parent. Or it can mean that you see each other monthly and that you talk frequently and that they sort of become almost a family member to you on sort of the other end of the spectrum. So it's very highly personalized, depending on what you're comfortable with and sort of the circumstances of why the biological parent placed the child for adoption, or in the case of foster care, why the child was placed into foster care, and based on what your child wants and needs if they are old enough to understand those dynamics and make the decision. I think most people are somewhat afraid of open adoption when they are fostering. Open adoption through a private adoption is a different story, and I'll talk about that at the end. But I think a lot of foster parents hear the term open adoption and they think, oh God, please no. And it's somewhat understandable. You know, the child is in foster care for a reason, usually because of abuse or neglect, although most commonly it is because of neglect. And foster care isn't usually a smooth and wonderful experience in terms of a foster parent interacting with a biological parent, especially if the case is moving toward adoption or has moved to adoption. That means that the biological parents haven't been compliant with what the courts asked them to do. So that means that probably more so than another foster care case, that it's, you know, just kind of contentious. Maybe the parents aren't, perhaps they're not making visits, maybe they're not complying with services. By the time you get to terminating the parental rights and moving toward adoption, it's usually not all like puppy dogs and flowers and butterflies. So understandably, a foster parent at the end of this road is typically like, no, I just want to adopt and we want them to be out of our lives forever. And while I understand that, I want to first tell you before I get into exactly how you get into an open adoption and how you prepare for one, that's just not a great idea to want them out of your lives forever. And I really try to tell foster parents that they need to think about not just what's best for them. In fact, this isn't about what's best for them at all, but what is going to be best for your child in the long term? You know, when your child is an adult and when your child sort of understands their story, what is going to be best for them? To look them in the eye and say, I really honored your birth family and I tried my hardest to help you have a connection with them. Or to look them in the eye and say, I just didn't want the inconvenience, and so I hid them from you or I kept them from you because I just didn't want to deal with it. You can imagine which is probably going to be better for the child in the end. So I would urge, if you're in that situation now where you're thinking about, okay, we're heading towards adoption, parental rights are probably going to be terminated, do I even want to offer an open adoption? I would really urge you to consider it. I also would urge you to consider that just because the biological parents are one way now does not mean that's how they will always be in the future. And I will give you a personal example, sort of as a testament to that. So when Jack's case was moving toward adoption, his parents were not doing well. They were both actively using. They didn't have jobs. They didn't have stable housing. Like, it was a hot mess. They weren't making their visits. They were canceling their visits all the time. And I definitely could not see a day when they would be productive, healthy people. I was just like, this is not going to end well. They're either going to overdose and die, or they're just going to disappear from his life forever. But let's see, how long has it been since that time? I think we're at 4 years now. 4 years later, they are both wonderful, healthy, happy people, and they are great parents, and they are great role models. So for those of you who are new to this podcast, just a quick update. Jack's biological parents went on to have two more children that they have full custody of, no open DCS cases. They both are clean and sober. They're working. They have a stable home. They are great parents. So people can change. And I hate to think about what would have happened, you know, 4 years ago, 4.5, almost 5 years ago at this point, if I would have just said, no, you know what? I'm done with them. They're still using. They don't show up for visits. I don't want them in my life. No, I'm not going to let them have an open adoption. I can't imagine how guilty I would feel now, how much Jack would have missed out on if I would have closed that door forever. So I'm really glad that I listened to other people who gave me the advice to say, just keep the door open. Enter into an open adoption, and then just sort of take it step by step, because now they are wonderful people, and it's really great to see Jack form his own relationship with them. And we'll also get into sort of the positive aspects of why you want to enter an open adoption here in a little bit too. Some of you may be wondering, well, what do you mean enter an open adoption? Is it your choice to have an open adoption or not? And yes, as a foster parent, that is something that you can choose. No one forces you to have an open adoption. No one forces you to have a closed adoption. So for better or worse, a foster parent, a pre-adoptive parent, sort of holds all the cards when a case is moved toward adoption. So I'm going to get a little bit too into like the weeds of this one. But when the case is moved to adoption, there are sort of two choices. You can enter into mediation with the biological parents and try to negotiate essentially for them to voluntarily give up their parental rights so that you can just like adopt and move on. And then the second option is that you go to trial and evidence is presented on both sides, both for and against why parental rights should be terminated, and a judge makes that decision. When you enter mediation, in some states like Indiana, you are required to try mediation before it goes to trial. You are trying to put the best case forward to convince the parents to give up their rights. And oftentimes, that includes presenting them with a post-adoption agreement. So you would sit down with your adoption attorney and talk about what post-adoption visits or contact might look like. And you want to make this quote unquote offer as competitive as possible to try to convince the biological parents to skip the trial, do it the easy way, and just voluntarily give up their rights. So that is one reason why you might start creating an open adoption agreement. The other reason, let's say if you didn't do mediation or you tried mediation and it didn't quote unquote work and you did go to trial, you can then do an open adoption agreement, you know, after rights have been terminated, and create an open adoption yourself. You can do this without a legal agreement. You can certainly just do it on sort of good faith and your own word, but I highly recommend working with your adoption attorney to create a post-adoption agreement because it protects you, it protects the child, and it also protects the biological parent, which I realize you might not be in the mood for right now, but I promise it is the right thing to do. So a post-adoption agreement is so important because it really helps protect you from the worst case scenario that you might be imagining as a foster parent right now. So let's say you're sort of in a similar situation that I was. Parents aren't making visits. Maybe they're heavy drug users. Maybe they're in and out of jail. Maybe they're in really bad relationships. Maybe they're homeless. Maybe they're not working. Like maybe they're making every bad decision in the world. And you're like, yeah, no, you're crazy if you think that I'm going to keep up visitation with these people once I don't have to anymore. But a post-adoption agreement allows you to keep the control and the power so that visits are only happening on healthy terms. And if the biological parents cannot meet those healthy terms, then the visits just don't happen. So I remember when my attorney first kind of presented this idea to me, I had this knee-jerk reaction of like, no, absolutely not. I'm not doing that. I'm not getting stuck having to visit these people all the time that are like toxic and awful people, because I was thinking of visitation like you do it in foster care. When you don't get to control the schedule, you don't get to control the location, you're just kind of told by a visitation supervisor or the caseworker, hey, this is how many visits the child is going to get with their parent, and they're at these times, and they're at this location, and too bad, so sad, if none of this is convenient for you, we're doing it anyway. And that is not what a post-adoption agreement looks like or should look like. It really gets to protect you. And so my attorney kind of counseled me through, hey, let's put these safeguards into place that make you feel comfortable that these visits will be productive, they will be positive, and no one is going to be stuck in anything negative or harmful or toxic. So there are a few things that we put in our post-adoption agreement that I'd like to share that could be helpful for you. Some of these things are pretty universal and you'll see them in almost every agreement. Some of them are specific to our situation. And there might be other things that you would want to put in here just based on your family needs or the biological parents and your concerns. So the first ground rule is that the visits always have to take place within a certain number of miles from our city or our home. And we did that so in case we ever had to, you know, move to Japan or move to California, that we wouldn't be stuck having to like come back to Indiana for visits, right? That was really to protect us. So it was clear that if we were to ever move, that the parents could still have their visits, but they would have to come to us. We don't have the time or the money to come to them. So that was sort of number one basic ground rule, pretty common. Another rule was that the visits have to take place on a mutually agreed upon location. So, usually I suggest a location and we see if it works for the parents. Some people have asked for examples of visitation locations. I would say, especially at first, don't do it anywhere private. So don't do it at their house. Don't do it at your house. You know, it's still a new relationship. You're still trying to build trust. And also I think it can just be, aside from like the safety and privacy issue, I think it can just be easier to build a relationship when you're both on neutral ground. So it varies based on the age of the child, but we really like restaurants and restaurant play areas, so like Chick-fil-A, McDonald's, like those places that have indoor play areas. Museums of any kind, children's museum, but really any kind of museum is always great. Libraries are fantastic. They usually have like a kid's play area where you can make a little bit more noise. Coffee shops are really great. Malls and mall food courts are awesome. When the weather's nice, of course, parks. So just really any place you can think of, an indoor playground. Some churches have like indoor playgrounds, or there are just indoor playgrounds where you have to pay for admission. I would say be careful of places where it's required to spend money to be there, whether that's a restaurant or, you know, like a trampoline park or something like that, because you have to take into account that the biological parents are probably not coming from a lot of money. They may not have any extra money, and even something that seems inexpensive to you could be a huge burden to them. So for us, if we ever suggest a place that is going to cost money, I always offer to pay. But you can just avoid that entirely and just do places that are free and open to the public. But if you do want to do something a little bit different, I think you should assume that, the cost is going to be on you. But again, if you just put that ground rule of we have to agree upon the location, then you're kind of covered. Another one was they can't bring guests without my permission. So I didn't want them bringing, you know, new girlfriends or boyfriends or other family members that I haven't met before or just friends. That was partly from a safety standpoint. I wanted to be sure I really knew the people who were coming, but also because I just didn't want Jack to be overwhelmed. Like, he's still just trying to build a relationship with them. And I know, of course, it can be tempting because they really want their friends and family to meet their child. But from a child's perspective, that's really overwhelming to them. It can be scary. And it takes away from the time that they have to build the relationship with their bio parent. So no guests without my permission ahead of time. A big one for us was that they had to be clean and sober for the visit. We did not require any kind of testing before the visit, although you could. I think logistically that would be tough because you would have to say, okay, well, where are they getting the testing? How do they get the results to you? Who's paying for the testing? How soon in advance of the visit do they have to have testing? I think you certainly could put that in there, but logistically it could be a hassle. So really this was just based on how they were appearing. If I felt like they were under the influence of anything, I could end the visit immediately and this contract would be null and void. Another big one for us was that they couldn't miss more than one visit without, you know, a previous or advanced notice well in advance. And they couldn't be more than 15 minutes late without a good reason or advanced notice. And that was for two reasons, primarily to protect Jack from any rejection. So my worst fear was that we would set up these visits and every time we would set them up, they wouldn't show. And then here's, you know, Jack, especially as he gets older, just like waiting for them to show up and they don't, and his heart is broken over and over again. So that was really primarily to protect him, that if they missed more than one without advance notice, and you can decide for yourself what advance notice looks like. I think for us, we put in like 48 hours. Or we're continuously late, the contract would be null and void. Also said that the agreement can end if the child doesn't want the visits, or I think the visits are harmful to him. So as he gets older, if he's just like, you know what, I really don't want to visit these people, then we don't have to. But also, especially as he was younger, I wanted to be really careful that we weren't locked into something that was harming him. So you know, if he would have started having escalated behaviors or showed signs of trauma or, you know, anger or frustration or depression or whatever the case might be, then obviously we would not continue this and the contract would be null and void. Some people have asked, well, you know, in foster care, I'm used to supervised visits. I take my child to a location. There is a visitation supervisor or a caseworker or a guardian ad litem or a CASA who's supervising the visit, and I don't need to be there. Can you do that in a post-adoption agreement? And the answer is yes. I mean, you could put anything you want, theoretically, in a post-adoption agreement. But again, kind of like with the drug testing, there are some logistical hurdles with that. So, you know, number one, what agency or person are you going to use to supervise the visits? And are they always going to be available when you need them to? Or are you going to wind up in that scheduling conundrum where you're stuck with inconvenient times that you don't want? And also, who's going to cover the cost of that? Because remember, this is post-adoption. We're done with foster care. DCS is no longer involved. The case is closed. So if you want a visitation supervisor, you would have to pay for it. I suppose theoretically you could put in your adoption agreement that if they want visits, they need to find and pay for a visitation supervisor. But again, I think that's unfairly placing a burden on them that most biological parents would probably not be able to meet. So I don't think that's a very fair one. So I would say if you'd like a supervisor, that would probably be something that you'd want to pay for yourself. But more than that, I also think you would be missing a big opportunity to build a relationship with the parents if you asked for a supervisor. So I think if it's an issue of safety, if you're like, well, I want a supervisor because I don't feel safe, then maybe an open adoption or at least visits aren't right for you right now. Because if you're not feeling safe enough to be with the parents in a public space, you know, your child probably shouldn't be there either, even with a visitation supervisor. And maybe you have an open adoption and the contact is that you just snail mail or email updates and pictures to the kid, but there's no visits yet. Because if it's not for a safety reason, if it's just, you know, you don't like them and you don't want to have to deal with them or it's awkward or whatever, I think that's a huge opportunity that you're missing of building a relationship with them too. Because one thing that I think people sometimes forget is it's not just your child's biological parent. This is someone that you are stuck with for the rest of your life, right? Jack's parents will be in my life as long as I'm alive. Because they are Jack's family, whether I like it or not, whether it's convenient for me or not. And so I want to build a great relationship with them too, to make this beneficial for everyone. So anyway, that's just my soapbox there. And of course, the biggest ground rule that you can set in your open adoption agreement is how often and how long these visits occur. And again, this is definitely on a spectrum. You may say it's once a year. You may say it's quarterly. We actually did monthly in our agreement, and we said like 2 hours for a visit. Now I'm really lucky that our relationship has progressed to a point where they really just do feel like family. It feels like a cousin that we're seeing. So we don't necessarily keep a monthly schedule anymore just because they have three kids, and between the three kids and the two adults, somebody's always sick. Or, you know, they've got three different school schedules. They've got different work schedules. We now live about 45 minutes apart. So we try to do it as frequently as we can. Sometimes we do it more often than once a month. Sometimes it ends up being like 3 months in between visits. But we've been able to build that trust and that relationship to know that we are both putting in our best effort. And we also don't stick to some of the things like the time of the visit now. Like, you know, again, that was something in there to protect myself in case this was becoming a contentious relationship. But because now I really do consider them extended family, I just am upfront with them at the beginning about how long the visit can be. You know, like, hey, we've got to go to something after this, so we can only meet for an hour and a half. Is that cool? Or if the visit's going well and everyone's happy and we don't have plans afterwards, we're like, yeah, let's just hang out until one of us gets tired, right? So it's much more casual and informal now. But we still have that visitation agreement in place because we wanted it to start out on very clear terms. So those were sort of the basics of how you come to an open adoption agreement and how you might structure visitation. And I think some other things that are really good to think about that aren't necessarily outlined in an agreement are things like, how will you communicate with them? You know, do you decide to sort of make them a family friend and it's just casual communication sort of all the time? Do you want it to be more formal and you'll send them kind of formal updates, you know, a couple of times a year, once a year, and fill them in on school and their child's interests? Particularly if you decide not to do visitation and you just want to do those updates instead, really think about what you want that to look like and what kind of effort you want to put in. I think that's really important. And with Jack's parents now, again, because we have a legitimate relationship now, and I actually really like and respect them as people, our contact is very much like any other extended family member. Like, I message his mom a couple times a week and I'll be like, oh my God, Jack said this super funny thing today, or like, look at this adorable video that I got of him doing whatever. And she'll text me updates. It's just a very kind of informal friendship now, which is great. But you might want to put some intention and intentionality into how you think about those updates at first until you start to build that true relationship. And again, I would just really urge you to be as open as you can with your open adoption. There are just so many positive aspects for your child that are so important. It's really showing your child, first of all, that you are honoring their family, you're honoring where they came from, and that you're really trying your hardest to keep that connection open. You know, ultimately, you can't be responsible for, you know, if their parents decide to reciprocate, if their parents decide to better themselves and want to be there for their child. But you can at least say, you know what, I gave it an honest effort. And that's really important. It also allows your child, when they're older, to ask them the hard questions, because they will have hard questions. When they want to know, you know, why did you neglect me? Why did you abuse me? Why couldn't you get off drugs to save me? Why this? Why that? You won't have to be faced with that burden alone. They can go directly to the source and ask those questions. And I think that can be very therapeutic for them. You can also learn about their health. Like, so often, you know, as an adoptive parent, you're filling out family health history and you just have to put big question marks. Gosh, I don't know your family's history of breast cancer or whatever the case might be. And you've got that really important connection and dialogue going to where you can ask those questions and understand any family health concerns or things like that. It can also be helpful in case, God forbid, something happens and they do need some kind of kidney donor or, you know, something of that nature, that they have those biological connections and biological ties there. I think that it helps the child trust you more. I think sometimes, particularly if you have adopted an older child who's maybe more aware of their situation or remembers a time before you, there's still a lot of trust to be built there. And I think it's very easy for children to romanticize their biological parents to protect themselves, right? Because it hurts to think like, well, maybe my parents just didn't want to get sober for me. Maybe my parents really just didn't love me or want me. And so it can be easy to protect themselves, to think, well, you know, my adoptive parents must have stolen me from them. They were trying really hard, but my adoptive parents just got impatient and wouldn't give them more time, right? It's very easy for them to romanticize this and want to blame the adoptive parents. And so I think having that connection open with their biological parents can help them understand the truth, whatever that means, right? And really understand who their bio parents are as people and why they made the choices they did and why you may have made the choices that you did. And I think it can also help them just understand how much they are loved and help deal with that rejection and trauma that is inherent to any adoption, particularly from foster care. I am so, so thankful that Jack will always see how hard he was loved. Like, he's already starting to have some questions, and I think those questions will just get more pointed as he gets older. But he will always see, whatever happened, I see that my bio parents are still showing up for me and still love me. And it's not that they just didn't want me and wanted to like wash their hands of me. And I am so grateful that he will have that. And I hope that it helps with the trauma that he will have to deal with and that he's already dealing with from foster care. So that's a little bit about open adoption. As you can see, it is not co-parenting. They don't get a say in where you send your child to school or how you dress your child or if you get your child immunized or not. Spoiler alert, get your child immunized. So don't be afraid of that. Don't be afraid that you're like opening up the door to a second set of parents that are going to be in your life making all these decisions. But do remember that who they are now isn't always who they're going to be. And if you can lay some groundwork in that post-adoption agreement that sets some rules for safety and trust, I would really encourage you to do so. And if the parents, you know, can't rise to the occasion or don't want to rise to the occasion, then that's on them. But I think it's up to all of us as adoptive parents and as foster parents to do the best we can to be as open as and embracing as we can on healthy terms, of course. That's why those agreements exist. And really hope that they take advantage of that. So, as always, if you have any questions on foster care or adoption or any topic ideas, please email me, elizabeth.friedland@gmail.com. You can also find me on Instagram at efriedland and shoot me a message there. And I very much appreciate you listening. Thanks, everyone. Hello, and welcome back to Instant Mom. So this may be my most controversial episode yet. We will see. Maybe I'm just a little nervous. That I feel like whenever we talk about foster care and adoption influencers, we always kind of get into hot water and people tend to be really defensive about this topic. Probably because most of us are guilty of committing one of these influencer sins, as I'll call them, that I'll talk about here in a minute. So I just want us all to start by taking a deep breath before we launch into this one, myself included. So let's do it all together right now. Okay. This episode is not intended to be mean-spirited, to make anyone embarrassed or ashamed. It's not meant to cancel anyone. It really is an opportunity for everyone listening, including myself, to think and to really reflect deeply on how we might be, even unconsciously, doing more harm than good when we're quote-unquote influencing in this space. And I also want to come right out and acknowledge that I have gotten this wrong a lot when I first started out. I have looked back at some old posts when I started out 7 years ago and I have cringed so hard, and I've deleted many of them. Because with what I know and believe now, but didn't know or believe back then, I realized that a lot of my content was harmful or tone deaf or otherwise damaging. I didn't know any better then, but I do know better now. And now that I know better, I try to do better. The key word here is try, because I'm sure I will probably still make a misstep in the future as I continue to learn even more and as society's views and opinions and knowledge about foster care and adoption continue to evolve. So I just want to come out and say, I am not innocent here. So it's okay. It's a safe space where we can all talk about these things, because as I mentioned earlier, we are probably all guilty of these. And on that note, I want to urge you to lean into any defensiveness that you might feel when you listen to this episode. I have personally found that if my immediate reaction to anything is, well, not me, or, well, not always, or some other kind of defensiveness, then that means that the narrative has probably struck a nerve with me and I need to do some reflecting. Rarely are our knee-jerk reactions totally accurate. So if you're one of those people who, as you're listening to this, you're getting riled up, you're getting defensive, I would just sincerely ask you to just really stop and reflect on it and think if maybe that defensiveness is because part of you realizes that maybe, like me, you kind of misstepped before and maybe have unintentionally, unconsciously contributed to some of these harmful influencer-style pieces of content that we've seen floating around there. And finally, before I get into this, I want to say that I try to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. I believe that a vast majority of foster care and adoption influencers who get it wrong think they're coming from a good place and they really do care and they are trying to just to raise awareness about foster care and adoption in general. There are a few exceptions of people who I think are absolutely intentionally, consciously being exploitative. But I try to extend that grace whenever possible because I've been there, right? And also, just to clarification, when I talk about influencers in this space, your mind might immediately go to people with a huge following. But I really am referring to anyone who might be publicly or even, I guess, privately, but have a large private following, might be talking about foster care and adoption and their foster care and adoption experiences on social media. So, even if you've got a following of 500, I would still technically classify you in this influencer space. All right, guys, so here we go. Being an influencer in the foster care and adoption space can be a really great thing. It can be used for good. I know there are so many misconceptions about foster care and foster parenting, that we're all in it for the money, which, we all know is hilarious because, most of us go into debt taking care of these children. I think I probably have done an episode about the misconceptions of foster care and foster parenting. So influencing in this space can be massively educational. It can create change. It can amplify voices that might not always be heard. It can inspire others to be a foster parent or to be involved in the system somehow, or just be more aware. And this is all wonderful. I am all for content, 2,000%, that exists for these truly educational purposes. That is great. We absolutely need more awareness of the realities of foster care, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And, Lord knows we need a lot of change in the space. So that is great. I just want to set aside the purely educational content that's out there. But it's so easy for this influencing to wander from educational into vanity-driven entertainment, into saviorism, exploitation. So we're going to dig into all of those. And I've got a couple of rules that I think all of us should follow when we are creating or posting content about foster care and adoption. So, rule number one, we should never, ever profit off the backs of the children in foster care and their stories, period. That probably seems really obvious, but I see this all the time. I have seen foster children on the cover of a foster parent's book. Now, granted, they were wearing sunglasses and hats in an attempt to like disguise them and, you know, protect their identity. But the fact is, you're still using someone else's child to sell your book. So, that's a no-no. They, you know, foster children and their stories should not be used to sell your books or your keynote session at your conference or your MLM business. I am looking at you, essential oil people. I won't fight with you now about MLMs in general. You know, if you've got one, like, you know, do your thing, but don't use your foster kids to sell it. They should not be on a promoted piece of content. So I say this so often that there's a promoted post from someone in the foster care space and it's a picture of their kids in foster care or a caption about their kid's story. And it's like, you can't do that. Like, it's just so unethical and icky. They should not be part of a sponsorship campaign or an ad campaign. And there is no wiggle room on this one, period. I don't care if you know, you're only showing their toes. I don't care if their faces are fully covered. Like it's just, oh, can you imagine? Like, can you just imagine for a minute that you are the biological mother and, you know, you've got all kinds of issues and struggles you're trying to overcome and you are at your absolute rock bottom of the rock bottom and your children have been taken from you. And you're scrolling through social media and you see your child on the cover of some stranger's book and they're using their story to profit. Like, can you imagine how enraged you would feel? And if you don't feel sympathy for the parent, like, imagine when that child grows up and they get older and they're able to understand their experience in foster care. Like, how do you think they're going to feel when they realize that they were sort of a tool for you to get likes or traffic or sales? Just please don't. You can absolutely write books about being a foster parent. You can write memoirs. You can do the keynote speeches. You can do the podcasts. but you cannot make money off of the back of a foster child and their stories. So just no. Number two, we should never, ever, intentionally or unintentionally, frame ourselves as saints or martyrs. And this is one that I will admit I got wrong so often. And I think sometimes I still get it wrong. Sometimes I think I'm like towing the line of being factual and educational and then like maybe accidentally slipping into that martyrdom thing. So sometimes the content that we think could be educational, like talking about the hard work of fostering, the sleepless nights, the expense of it all, the loneliness, the heartbreak, that can end up becoming a tribute to ourselves for being like just so virtuous to make those sacrifices. I don't think we're doing it intentionally most of the time. And I do think that showing the realities of foster parenting is important. It is hard. It does require sacrifice. And anyone who's thinking about becoming a foster parent should know that it's not all puppies and rainbows, and they should know the sacrifice that is required. So there's this very thin line between the factual education of that experience and the here I am, mother martyr, suffering for this poor child. So that's just a tough one that we always have to check ourselves on. So in practical terms, like what could this look like? I think back to a lot of selfies that I would post in sort of the beginning of my foster care career, for lack of a better word. And it would be like, it'd be the middle of the night. It'd be like 4 a.m. I've been up literally all night with a screaming baby. And the caption would say something about like how exhausted I was, how depressed I was, how alone I felt. That was all true. And those are all very common feelings and experiences. And it's all fair to talk about. But it could have been better if I framed it less about like, woe is me, and more about, hey, here's the reality of foster parenting. And then I turned it into an educational moment. And here's how you can support foster parents if you're not ready to be one yourself. Or But this is nothing compared to what a child in care might experience. But you know what? It is an honor to get to wake up with this baby every hour when someone out there may be desperately missing this moment and wishing they were the ones to be up in the middle of the night rocking her. Another practical tip, I think, to avoid the martyrdom but maintain the honesty is to keep it short and keep it infrequent. So if you start to notice that all of your posts are about your sacrifices and how hard it is, then maybe it's time to pull back a little on that and put the focus back on the children in care and foster care in general and turn that more educational. So keep it short, keep it infrequent, and focus on the more important aspects of foster care to talk about rather than just how hard it is for us. And I think it's also okay to lean into how hard it is. We all need support, but there are more appropriate places to do that, like foster care support groups, for example, right? That would probably be a better platform to have those kind of like woe is me posts than doing it in a foster care and influencer space, where it could be misconstrued into martyrdom. Rule number three, we are not the better option and we are not saviors. I feel like this is the one that I'm going to get the most hate about. So again, let's just remember how if we feel defensive about it, we're just gonna like lean into that for a minute and really reflect before sending me hate mail. because I think some people, when they hear, hey, foster parents are not the better option, they're like, what do you mean? This child was in foster care because they were neglected and abused. Like, what do you mean? I'm not better than the person that beat them. That is not what we're saying here. So let's take a beat and think about this. So just personal story before I get into this to show that I've been guilty of this. So I'm like cringing so hard when I recall this post, but once very early in my time as a foster parent, I wrote a caption that said, but if I don't save them, who will? Which like, oh God, that is textbook gross saviorism. And I remember at the time, I was trying to make the point of like, be the change you wish to see in the world. Or, you know, like, it's our duty as humans to help another human out. Like, those would have been great captions, or at least better captions. But instead, I like literally turned myself into Jesus Christ. Like, no one will save these children if not for me. So I just a few things to keep in mind about saviorism. It might be saviorism if you think that you and only you can save or heal the child in your care. None of us are good enough to do that. All we can do is support that child, but we cannot save them and we cannot heal them. It might be saviorism if you ignore or minimize a child's connection to their biological family. So again, like, biological family is very important. Just period. It might be saviorism if you think that you're better than the child's biological parents. This is the one that hits people hard sometimes. And this still, I really have to think about this one. Although I believe in it, this one is the hardest for me personally. It's so easy, especially if you have just a heartbreaking case of a child who was, you know, really badly physically abused, let's say, to think, well, of course I'm better than them. Like, I didn't beat this child within an inch of their life. Yeah, I'm better than them. But that also discounts the good that can be in that person, how they got to that place in their life where they did that, what happened to them when they were a child, when they were growing up, that might have robbed them of the lessons that they needed to learn to be a better person. Now, don't get me wrong. We are not excusing the parents' behavior in any of this. We are not making excuses for it. We are not saying, well, no big deal. You had it rough. None of that is happening here. We're just saying that we are all equal fuck-ups, essentially. And maybe we have fucked up in very different ways, but none of us are perfect. And we are not inherently better than anyone else, really. But we are not inherently better than the child's parents. And in some ways, the child's parents can be better than us, right? They have connections to perhaps their culture or their background. They can know things about that child that we don't know yet, or we may never know. So just really gut check that. Could be saviorism, as you think your way of parenting is the best way or the only way or the right way to parent. I see this a lot in content. Like, people will post about, you know, a child who just got back from a visit, and they're ranting about, you know, mom didn't feed the baby the way she was supposed to. Mom didn't play with the baby the way she was supposed to. And I'm guilty of this too. I would sometimes have posts that have since been deleted, thank God, where I would complain that Jack's parents didn't do things the way I thought they should do things. But everybody's parenting style is different. There is no right or wrong way. And everybody's a bad parent compared to someone else. Like, any parent listening, I could catch you at a time where I would be like, whoa, you made that decision? Like, that was a really shitty parenting move, right? So that can be saviorism. If you're thinking that your way is the best way and the only way, and that is it. And my favorite, it might be saviorism if you completely discount, downplay, or outright don't believe there are any systemic and systematic racial biases and motives in removing children from their bio families. This one you don't see blatantly as often. Like, most people are smart enough not to come right out and just be like, there's no racism in foster care. Although sometimes you will see that in the deep in the comment section, and it just like infuriates me. But I think there are some like dog whistles that you hear, especially with white foster parents when posting about children of color in their care, that it's like, oh man, you have no idea how deep some of this racism and injustice goes that is inherent to the way the foster care system was built. That is a whole other episode, and I have a lot of great books I'd love to recommend on that taught me so much about this. But long story short, like, Black children are removed from their homes far more often than white children, like, regardless of the circumstances. For example, like, Black children have been removed essentially for far less than a white family might be removed for. And white families are given way more benefits of the doubt. They're given way more support. Their intentions are always presumed to be good over a Black family. There's just so much racism and bias in foster care. And if you're going to deny any of that, or if like you're kind of hinting at it or around it, like, that's saviorism. And that saviorism is sort of reductionist either or thinking. So, you know, if you're saying, you know, my kids' biological parents made bad choices, and so they are bad, that's reductionist thinking. Yes, they made bad choices. They are not necessarily bad people. There could be good within them. Or, you know, I see this all the time. I'm going to go on a slight tangent here, but I see so many times someone will post a picture of their foster children. My favorite is when they technically have disguised their faces, but just barely. Like, they'll draw like the thinnest white line over their eyes. And it's like, come on now. Like, you're not actually following the spirit of the law. And they'll say something like, prayers for a good outcome. And it's like, we all know what you want that outcome to be. You want that outcome to be that the kids stay with you. And of course, you know, I don't presume to know the ins and outs of every case. And, you know, we have all heard of cases where children were reunited with family that ended up being dangerous and children were injured or killed because of it. In fact, I fostered a newborn baby who was later reunited with her mother, and it resulted in her death. So I am not blind to that reality. But so often those posts are about the good news that they want people to pray for is that the children stay with them. And the bad news is that the children have to have more visits, or the children are going to be reunified, or that another family member shows up who learns about the children being in care. And that is like classic saviorism in action. And as I said earlier, just because a bio parent made bad choices doesn't mean there's no good in them, and it doesn't examine the causes or the why behind those bad choices, nor does it consider the good that's lost when a child is not with their biological parents. So the saviorism, I think, sometimes can be harder to detect in the posts, but I especially see this in the big influencers, like the ones who have hundreds of thousands of followers and their entire content machine are their children of color in, you know, these professional shots of them like wandering through a prairie, right? And the mom's in like the big floppy hat and the sundress, and there's always a Bible caption there, which that's fine. Like I also believe in Jesus, but usually there's some kind of like slightly, if not overtly, white saviorism undertone or overtone in those posts. So that's one that really feeds into a lot of the content and sort of is the foundation of a lot of the content that I see. Rule number four, children are not accessories. So I just had a great segue into that when I talk about those, especially the bigger influencers whose feed is filled with the professional photos of the children in care. So I think it's great to get professional photos of children in care, both by themselves and with you. Like a child should have their childhood documented so that when they are older, they can see how well loved they were and see how much they were cared about. So that's great, but that doesn't always need to be public, right? A lot of times it's very clear that the child is being used as a like machine, right? You get these cute little brown baby photos of this adorable white Utah mom foster care influencer, and you just watch the likes go up. And that is kind of outright exploitation and clearly using the child as an accessory. And it usually goes hand in hand with making money off the backs of the child too, right? Usually those are the posts that I'm talking about that I see are promoted or have a brand partnership. Like they are getting paid for using that foster child in the photo. Rule number five, children should not be seen in the post, period. This one I have violated big time. I don't know many people who haven't violated this one. So everything I'm about to say, please know I am also directing at myself. And this one is one that I really just kind of more recently within the past year have sort of come down hard on for myself. So technically, you could show a child in foster care on social media, but you had to cover their face. So a lot of influencers would get away with this by doing these like very skinny thin lines over the eyes of the child. Like you can obviously tell who the child is. If you were a relative of the child or knew them somehow, you would be able to recognize this child. I would sometimes put like a big sunglasses graphic over the face or the eyes of the child. And I get it because they're so cute and you want to show people how cute these kids are. And you're like, oh my God, look at this adorable kid and it's exciting. I get it. I think this is one of those that does often come from a good place. But I have more recently started to think about how devastating that is to the biological family and how devastating that could be to the child when they grow up and they see that. So first of all, to the biological family, I mean, this really hit home when I was following an Instagram account of a mother who her children were taken from her. They were in DCS custody. She admits she made some bad choices. She was able to be reunified, and she is a wonderful parent, at least from what I can tell, following her on social media. And she talks about how one day she was kind of just scrolling through Instagram and she was at her rock bottom and, you know, just like strung out and I think on the verge of like contemplating suicide, like that kind of low. And she saw a photo of her child and the child's face was kind of barely covered, but she knew it was her child and, you know, went to this person's profile and just saw all of these photos of the child. And she talks about how in one way it was comforting to see that like, okay, obviously she's in a place where she's being well taken care of. She's in clean clothes. It looks like she's well fed, right? These look like decent people. But also how, I think she said it like, it felt like someone kicked her in the stomach because she felt like they were using her child for likes, for attention, to feel good about themselves. But also it wasn't their child. It isn't their child to share. That was her child. And I think that's something that foster parents, that we often miss when we are talking about our content. I mean, we obviously love these children like they are our own children. And in many ways, it is healthy to refer to them as our own, right? Like, you know, you probably have the same rules for your foster children as you do your biological children, or at least you should for the most part, unless they have special needs or accommodations that may warrant different rules. And, you know, hopefully when you're in public, you don't introduce them as like, well, this is my adopted son, this is my foster son, and this is my biological son, right? So in that regard, it's very helpful that we see them as our kids and we love them like they're our kids, but they are not our kids. The whole point of foster care is that we give them back. And so by taking ownership of them in this way that you are documenting them for the world to see, I think can be very damaging and can also be like very demotivating. Demotivating? Is that a word? Unmotivating? I should know this. I'm a communications major. It can not be very motivating to a biological parent who might see this and think, well, gosh, that looks like they're living a great life. Like they don't even need me, right? So, you know, maybe take those photos for the child to have later, for the biological parent to keep once they're reunited, hopefully if they're reunited, maybe send them privately to your friends and family to share those moments. But that doesn't need to be content and entertainment for public consumption. And as I said, I've definitely gotten this one wrong because I just wasn't thinking of the impact that it had. Okay, I'll leave it there. I was going to talk about a more specific story of a foster parent, but the point is not to point out any individual who may be guilty of this, because I am also guilty of this. So we're going to go from a place of grace right now. So, you know, children are not accessories and children should not be seen on social. I think the place where I have personally become comfortable is to show so little of them that it could literally be a stock photo, right? So like, if you've got a baby and you show like their adorable chubby toes, if that's literally all you're showing, I don't necessarily feel like that's violating anything, because you wouldn't know whose child that is. That child probably wouldn't be recognized by just a toe. But you know, it gets so blurry so quickly, even just like taking a photo of the child from the back, like you could still tell if that's your child from the back, right? So it's just, I think it's best to just keep them off and be creative with other ways to represent the idea of you fostering without actually showing their images. And this has been a hard one for me too, because really the past like 9 months or so, we've done a lot of really short-term placement or respite placements. And the kids are always so stinking cute. So the first thing I want to do instinctually is to post a picture on social media and be like, squee, look at how cute they are. And I haven't done that because that's a line I'm holding with myself. So I would just encourage you to do the same as well. I think we're at rule number 6 now, although I have lost count, but I didn't number my rules in my show notes here. So rule number six is that their stories are not our stories to share. And this is again, one that I definitely violated in the beginning. While I never told specific details, I never shared names, I definitely told way too much that it wasn't my child to share their story. And for the biological parents, you know, their story was not mine to share either. So I would just urge you, when you are creating content that talks about your foster parent experience, that you just keep things incredibly general. My gut check is always, hey, let's say that mom and dad, whatever they're struggling with now, let's say that 4 years from now, they completely turn their life around and they are just a model citizen and a model parent. And let's say they stumble upon everything, every piece of content that I've put out there. Would I be proud to share this with them? Or would I be like a little embarrassed and feel like I should kind of apologize and be nervous about their reaction? That's my personal gut check. And even now, it's a little tricky because Jack, of course, is my son, and I do technically have the legal right, at least, to share his story. Although, of course, I understand as parents, we all have different ideas of what we may and may not be comfortable with sharing about our own children, and that's fine. But his biological parents' stories are not mine to share. And so even now when I do share anecdotes or stories or photos, I always ask them first, like, hey, are you okay with me sharing this and getting that permission? And that can be tricky as I kind of move forward and talk about the open adoption. But I think that's just really key, is that they're not our stories to share. It's not anybody else's business. And then obviously just for privacy purposes, we have to keep that all, close to the vest. So I see this a lot in content. Usually this is with the smaller influencers, because I think the larger influencers maybe are more concerned about their privacy, but with sort of the smaller followings, the sort of average Joes, us average Joes in the foster parent space, will tend to share a little bit more than we should. And again, that is not our business to share. I also see this a lot in the memoir space or the book space or the keynote space. A lot of the sort of, I don't know, cross content that people have developed, again, just kind of uses stories of people in an exploitative way for their own gain. And we just always have to really gut check. Should I share this? Like, is it helpful for me to share this? Do I have the legal right to share this? Do I have the ethical and moral right to share this? Can I get to this point without sharing this information? I think that one is really key, because most of the time, whatever larger point you are trying to make, you can make that point without violating the privacy of the child or the family, even if you're trying to keep it general. So those are my foster parenting influencer rules. Hopefully I haven't lost too many of you along the way. Hopefully I'm not going to get a bunch of mean comments here. And again, like I said, this isn't to call anybody out. I think, except for the making money off of a foster kid, I've never done that. But with everything else, I have probably violated all of these rules, and luckily have gone back and looked at a lot of that early content and been like, oh my God, what was I thinking? And have since deleted that. So it's okay if you've made those mistakes along the way. It's okay if you're looking at some of your recent posts and thinking, oh, yikes, I didn't think about that. That's okay. Just go ahead and delete them. And now you know better. And now you can share those insights with other new foster parents who might be thinking of this. We just, we have to try to educate ourselves and try better. Guys, it's to the end of this podcast. I can't come up with words anywhere. Try harder and do better. And for those who are outright just sort of manipulating their followers through using the images of these children, the children's stories, the woe is me white savior thing, like, we can call those out. Like, if it is obvious that they know better and they just don't care, like, I'm okay with dropping a comment on their post and being like, yeah, just don't do that, right? But anyway, also curious if there are any other rules he would add, any kind of guidelines that you keep in mind when you're talking about your foster parenting experience. Let me know and I'll share those too. Maybe we have like a part two of lessons that you have learned or rules that you follow. So as always, would love to hear your questions, your comments. Hopefully I can cover all of those in a future episode. You can send me an email to elizabeth.friedland@gmail.com, or you can also follow me on Instagram, where I try not to violate these rules, @efriedland. And as always, thank you guys so much for listening.